My name's Diane Fields. I'm from the Sydney branch of Socialist Alternative, and I'll be chairing the session today. And I'd like to welcome everyone to the final day of Marxism 2018. And hopefully you can all stick around for the rest of the events right to the end of the day. Our speaker today on, and this is the session, Tear Down the Statues, Australia's History Wars. Our speaker today is Tim Arnott. He's from the Brisbane branch of Socialist Alternative. He's a delegate to the Queensland Teachers Union, and he's also involved in the Refugee Active Collective up in Brisbane in terms of his own activism. And we'll just hand over right away to him.
Thanks, Dan. Well, I want to actually pick up from where Jeff Bailey on Friday night. That's an absolute indictment on my part. Jeff Bailey left us on Friday night talking about Charlottesville, because the stated aim of the fascists mobilising in a national rally at Charlottesville was against the plans by the local council to tear down a Confederate statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general fighting to defend slavery in the South. At that rally, as Jeff said, they murdered an anti-racist activist, Heather Heyer. In response, a massive wave of protest was sparked all across the United States, particularly targeting those symbols of Confederacy in southern towns. So I want to talk about one example that happened in Durham in North Carolina, where hundreds of protesters gathered at their local Confederate statue, and a number of activists tied ropes around the neck of that statue, tore it to the ground, and police actually issued out warrants for the arrest of 8 activists, including Takaya Thompson. In response, just like that scene out of the 1960 Spartacus film, hundreds of people turned up at the county jail declaring that it was they who also tore down the statue, and that if fighting white supremacy is a crime, then yes, they are guilty. Now, the debate about tearing down the statues has come across the oceans to Australia, not so much in such a fierce question, but it's nevertheless been really important, with Stan Grant even just simply raising the question, not even tearing down the statue of Captain Cook in Hyde Park, but just simply questioning the inscription which says, "Discover this territory, 1770. And for raising a simple question as that, he was howled down and received absolute condemnation from the media and from politicians. Now, this should not be unexpected. As Karl Marx articulated in the German ideology, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has at the same time means over control of mental production. And if you take a cursory glance at the people that are celebrated by our rulers, the monuments to them in parks and gardens, the people in whose names are inscribed in towns all across Australia, gives you a picture that Australia's ruling elite truly are a pack of racist bastards, glorifying the very perpetrators of colonial brutality while outrightly ignoring the history of genocide that has been committed. So a statue of Lachlan Macquarie in Sydney's Hyde Park has for years attracted rightful condemnation and attention from Indigenous activists and historians. So as Governor of New South Wales up until 1821, Macquarie stole Aboriginal children from families with the stated intent of assimilating them culturally. In response to Aboriginal resistance defending their land, Macquarie ordered punitive massacres and instructed colonial troops to actually hang the bodies of Indigenous people from trees to strike the greater terror into the survivors. A plaque near the statue's base describes this bloodthirsty murderer as a perfect gentleman, a Christian and supreme legislator of the human heart. The Captain Cook statue and the inscription of "Discover This Territory 1770 proves the lie that the whole foundation of Australia is built on terra nullius, which has been used for so long to justify British colonial invasion and the racist society constructed after it. Now, Australian capitalism was built on stolen land and the blood and broken lives of Indigenous people, but also Torres Strait and South Sea Islanders. So slavery, you know, it's a key question for people in the United States, but slavery has its own history here in Australia. Queensland's sugar industry was built through the slave labour of 62,000 men and women, kidnapped from up to 80 Pacific Islands and brought to Australia in irons to make the fortunes of some of the industry's most iconic companies, such as CSR. One such slave trader, Robert Towns, built his fortune out of, you know, selling literal bodies, and then when he settled on the coast of Queensland, he was the first to actually establish a cane farm using the very labour of slaves he'd stolen. And Towns was, you know, his namesake is Townsville in central Queensland. Now, this is not the history that prevails in schools, media and popular culture, however. Precisely because the ruling class benefits from generations of land theft and slavery, and because that land theft and the murder of the Indigenous people by the state continues to this very day, our leaders are at pains to bury the past. Any acknowledgement of genocide in Australia's schools is greeted with howls that teachers are un-Australian, and as recently as 2014, then Education Minister Christopher Pyne was complaining that the current history taught in schools emphasises too much on white Australia's dark past. He announced a review into the education curriculum, demanding there to be more emphasis given to what he called the significance of Judeo-Christian values to our institutions and way of life. The debates that we've seen this year around changing the date of Australia Day and the Turnbull government's savage attacks on local councils refusing to celebrate January 26 are also indicators. In fact, none of this is new. Ever since historians, activists and authors began to lift the lid on Australia's ugly past in the 1960s, the past of brutal massacres and generations of dispossession, the ruling class has waged a ferocious backlash, attempting to re-establish that narrative. This became more pronounced in the 1980s and 1990s, as there was a concerted pushback generally in society against the gains of the earlier period. So not just against the newly won land rights for Indigenous people, but also against workers' rights, against education, healthcare, even the idea that multiculturalism is something that's beneficial to society came under scrutiny. The backlash was led not just by right-wing politicians led by John Howard and commentators, but also a smattering of historians such as Geoffrey Blainey and Keith Windschuttle, employed to systematically undermine the orthodoxy that had become accepted with the diligent work of progressive historians such as Henry Reynolds, Lyndall Ryan, Stuart McIntyre and Manning Clark. The history wars, as they were called, have never truly ended, precisely because our rulers continue to exploit and oppress the majority of us, you know, covering over the sordid history that Australia was built on and using rank nationalism to paper over class differences. Now, for any student of history in schools during the 19th and early 20th centuries, the only history that you would have received was that of Queen and Country when it came to Australia. After World War I, and the so-called birth of the national identity created by Australia's involvement in Gallipoli, more Australian perspectives made it into history texts, but they were still bound up with the celebration of the British Empire right up until the 1960s. In the universities, students of Australian history were taught just as much about Britain and its other colonies as they were about Australia. So the University of Sydney, for instance, taught Australian history with such faithful attention to British origins that the First Fleet was often yet to leave Portsmouth by the time the first term's lectures had ended. The motto of Sydney University, which is Sedere Mens Aeternam Mutato, means the same spirit under new skies. So literally transplanting British society onto the Australian continent. The University of Melbourne, students right up until the 1960s couldn't enrol in Australian history without first doing English history. In their contributions to what was to be the single authority of Australia, the Australian volume of the Cambridge History of the British Empire, published in 1933, historians extolled the virtues of that empire. For instance, the wool industry in Australia was held up as a perfect example of the process of empire development, while the gold rush represented a magnet to attract the better type of British migrant. There was absolutely nothing said in this volume of invasion or even of the frontier wars, or even the massacres that, you know, this is published in 1933. The last state-sanctioned massacre actually took place only 5 years before in Coniston in 1928. And if you read about that history, it'll make your blood boil about the murder of 60 to 70 Indigenous people at the hands of the Northern Territory Police. Now, left and radical historians emerged in the 1930s onwards, such as Ian Turner, who was a communist, and Brian Fitzpatrick, a fellow traveller of the Communist Party and one of the founding members of the Australian Council of Civil Liberties. The Communist Party stands out during this period as one of the key organisations that stood for full social, economic and political rights for Indigenous people, such as equal pay, the rights to organise, an end to all Jim Crow-style colour restrictions across Australia, and an end to the stolen generation. In 1931, the CPA published their draft program for the struggle against slavery, which was a call to arms for white workers to champion the rights of Indigenous people in their unions, and which articulated a clear understanding of the basis on which Australian capitalism was built on. The CP went on to contribute to significant Aboriginal struggles and strikes, such as the Torres Strait Islander Pearlers in the 1930s, the Pilbara strikes in the 1940s, and the famous Gurindji strike in the 1960s. Their influence grew from the 1930s onwards, precisely when the consolidation of the Stalinist politics and the politics of the Popular Front within the party was made complete. So this led to left nationalism taking pride of place in their histories of Australia, rather than a scathing critique of Australian capitalism and the Australian state. So Brian Fitzpatrick's The British Empire in Australia from 1834 to 1939 is a detailed account of the expansion of the colonies and the establishment of the squatters movement in Australia, yet it actually makes no mention of the extermination of Indigenous populations. Geoffrey Blainey, in his introduction to that book, identifies that while rebelling against the monarchist establishment historians and academia, Fitzpatrick was certainly not the first nationalist historian and shares company with many conservative historians who also saw British imperialism as chafing on the bit of Australia to expand and prosper. In the late 50s and early 60s, Australian universities began to expand, leading to greater numbers of students and increasing the size of departments, including social sciences. This increased the capacity for more people to be influenced by debates within the academy, and also provided greater scope for critical understandings and new paths to be explored. So in 1962, the historian Manning Clark published the first volume of his History of Australia, marking a break with both left nationalist and bourgeois mainstream histories of Australia. Clark was himself an establishment historian, a professor of history at Melbourne University and later the ANU, making the break with traditional telling of Australian history all the more significant. There was to be 6 volumes in total of his history, which became the best-known general history of Australia. And it was to Manning Clark that, much later, Liberal Party leaders such as John Hewson and John Howard in the 1990s attributed the original sin of his so-called unduly tragic views of Australia's past. In his first volume, Clark acknowledges the endurance of Aboriginal society on the Australian continent, opening with a clear statement that Indigenous people had populated Australia for at least 50,000 years, and stated that from colonisation, atrocities were committed against Aboriginal people. He outlined one instance where two Aboriginals were captured, tied to a tree and shot, and in a few short years, it had become commonplace for the governor to order a party of soldiers to drive Aboriginals from any area where supposed outrages had occurred. Now, this marked a significant shift in the writing of Australian history and came under increasing criticism from the right as each population, as each volume was published. But his new approach, fortunately, was not alone. In 1968, anthropologist Bill Stanner gave a speech on the ABC titled The Great Australian Silence, describing the structural neglect of Aboriginal dispossession and its aftermath that Australian history had been responsible for. So he articulated, "It is a structural matter, a view from a window which has been carefully placed to exclude a whole quadrant of the landscape, producing something like a cult of forgetfulness practiced on a national scale." In the same lecture, Stanner identified that a new generation of students and young academics, their political outlook shaped by the broader radicalisation in society and the expansion of the university system, were laying the basis for a new understanding of Australian history. Henry Reynolds was such one student of history inspired by Stanner's speech. He went on to edit a work analysing the interactions between Aboriginals and settlers in 1972, and in 1981 he published his first book, The Other Side of the Frontier, which looked at how colonisation impacted on Indigenous society. He went on to write over 10 books and innumerable academic journal articles looking at the impacts of colonisation and genocide on Indigenous society. Now, one thing he pioneered was trying to establish the scale of the frontier wars and the death toll. So by looking at the records of white casualties, which were actually meticulously kept by the settlers, and comparing the rudimentary weapons of Indigenous people to the muskets and rifles of settlers, Henry Reynolds estimated the death toll of the frontier wars across Australia to constitute about 20,000 Indigenous victims. His estimate has become widely accepted by historians, including some right-wing ones, such as Geoffrey Blainey, who we'll hear about later. Another historian of note is Lyndall Ryan, who wrote The Aboriginal Tasmanians in 1981, analysing the territory where the brutal massacres and expulsions were most complete. She faced fierce criticism at the hands of Keith Windschuttle, which we'll also hear about. Lyndall Ryan has since gone on to map the massacres of the frontier wars across the entirety of the Australian continent. No mean feat, given that these include over 170 sites of atrocities in eastern Australia. Now, any acknowledgement that Australia was built on genocide is anathema to our rulers. Right-wing politicians, media and historians, backed by the wealth and power of mining and pastoral magnates, have always opposed this true history, precisely because it reveals their wealth and gains have come dripping from head to foot from every pore with blood and dirt. So while there was opposition to the revelations of Clark and Stanner from the outset, the concerted backlash began in the 1980s. A critique published in The Australian labelled Manning Clark's History of Australia volumes as a labour of hatred and distress nurtured by bitterness and sustained by repugnance. Clark's fifth volume was criticised for being bitter and cynical and claimed that he was a man who hated his own society. Well, maybe that's true. Key opposition came from the pages of the right-wing Quadrant magazine, which was founded during the Cold War with the backing of the CIA. By the 1980s, Quadrant was heavily funded by Hugh Morgan's Western Mining, and Hugh Morgan was later to become the president of the Business Council of Australia. So Geoffrey Blainey argued in Quadrant that while previous generations of historians, you know, with their what he called the Three Cheers view of history, the whole monarchist celebration and triumph, he said, well, okay, I reject that, but also Manning Clark has swung the pendulum too far the other way with what he called the black armband view of history. So Geoffrey Blainey was the historian who caused a massive controversy in 1984, stating that Australia should restrict immigration, particularly from Vietnam and Asia. And when I was a student at Melbourne University in the early 2000s, as the university restructured to implement the Melbourne model, they scrapped dozens of studies of Asian history and society and placed Geoffrey Blainey at the head of the one and only studies of Asia, literally called Asia. And that was the one subject you could attend. Another contributor to this collection was John Carroll from the La Trobe University, who argued that this generation was infected by a paranoid hatred of authority expressed in direct attacks on the society's leading values and institutions. So they're not all wrong. But he accused them of hedonism, hatred, and ideological treason. Fellow La Trobe University lecturer Claudio Valise also wrote a scathing critique of Volume 5 of Clark's History in Quadrant in the 80s. Now, it's impossible to separate the war of words taking place during this period from the political developments taking place on the ground. Powerful mining interests were being threatened by new land rights legislation, which, however inadequate for providing justice for Indigenous people, did provide a level of autonomy and a basis of opposition to ongoing theft of land. According to the editor of Quadrant, Robert Mann, Henry Reynolds' histories were crucial to influencing the High Court judges who, in 1992, ruled in favour of Mabo in discovering native title in common law. The Wick decision of 1996 renewed the alarmist campaign of the pastoral landholders. So John Howard, as leader of the opposition in 1988, was cohering these forces and forging the backlash nationally. He published a document called Future Directions, which slandered historians as professional purveyors of guilt who taught Australians to be ashamed of their past. He seized on Blainey's black armband term later when he returned as leader of the Liberal Party and then Prime Minister in 1996, stating, "I reject the black armband view of history that says most Australian history since 1788 has been little more than a disgraceful story of imperialism, exploitation, racism, sexism, and other forms of discrimination. One of the more insidious developments in Australian political life over the past decade or so has been the attempt to rewrite Australian history in the service of a partisan political cause." His campaign slogan in 1996 was "Governing for All of Us," which was coded dog whistling to indicate he was intending to marginalise minorities. During this period, a new term appeared in the common parlance of the history warriors, that of political correctness, a term used by the right and neoconservatives who depict society as being divided by left-wing elites who bully everyday people into submission on questions of gender and race, but in reality is a term used to attack any criticism of the right's agenda. When the Bringing Them Home report was published in 1997, detailing the atrocities committed during the stolen generations, it came under serious attack from Howard, right-wing commentators and Quadrant, who all characterised Aboriginal witnesses as notoriously unreliable and claimed that, prior to World War II, half-caste children had to be removed to rescue them from ostracism in the family, while post-World War II, it was done to protect them from paternal neglect and abuse. Sounds familiar? Piers Ackerman's comments in the Daily Telegraph demonstrate how the right attacks the whole methodology of any historians attempting to tell the truth about Indigenous dispossession. And I quote, "Bringing Them Home relies on untried, untested, unsworn and unsubstantiated statements presented by tragically, emotionally disturbed individuals to a willing audience of social engineers bent on attracting a new welfare market." In the late 1990s, Keith Windschuttle emerged as a key history warrior, and while having been retired, largely irrelevant to the history departments, and a historian of very little effect in his career, he was nevertheless promoted and touted by the right to further his agenda. Windschuttle's opening salvo in the late 90s accused any claims of frontier violence as complete fabrication, and accused all historians across Australia as being in collusion, exaggerating the scale of the violence, and basically said they were lying. So the first book he wrote was literally called The Fabrication of Aboriginal History, which was published in 2002. It focused on Indigenous Tasmania and argued that they were a primitive, maladapted and dysfunctional people who had survived for 35,000 years, more or less by luck. As well as based on outright racist caricatures of Indigenous people, Windschuttle's technique in writing out the genocide committed by colonists was to dismiss any verbal accounts. So as this was the key manner in which Indigenous history was preserved, it completely ignored any Aboriginal account of the murders that took place. Now, Tasmania's Black Wars from 1824 to 1830 saw brutal massacres carried out against Indigenous groups, as well as more organised responses and retaliation. So, as more colonists flooded into the island, Aboriginal attacks soared from 20 in 1824 to over 250 in 1830, while colonial killing squads escalated their savagery. There's no clear numbers of Indigenous victims during this period, but have been established by multiple historians as over 1,000. Windschuttle's fabrication relies on government documents, which, in relation to the Black Wars, hardly began to appear until 1827. However, the question of Indigenous people on Van Diemen's land was so central to life up until 1833 that this whole reliance on simply one kind of source was clearly designed from the outset to completely ignore the realities of these killings. Windschuttle fully intended to publish a second volume of his fabrication, focusing on the frontier wars in Queensland, but to this date has failed to do so. Because, since it's colonised later, Queensland was host to some of the most significant battles in the frontier wars in the whole country. So the Kalkadoon people of what is now the Mount Isa region carried out probably one of the first guerrilla-style campaigns of warfare for 8 years. Unfortunately, it was brutally crushed by the colonisers, which, in the battle that happened on Battle Mountain, saw 800 men, women and children, all Indigenous, slaughtered by both the military and the native mounted police. Additionally, with Queensland, there was more and better primary sources available, meaning that there's so much evidence pointing to clear brutalities carried out by the newly emerging state that Windschuttle has been flatly unable to refute such evidence. So let's have a look at things today. Well, while it may seem that history wars are no longer raging, they never have truly been concluded either. The heat has been taken out of many of the battles, partly because the right has been so successful in pushing back many of the gains of the land rights struggle. Additionally, the state has moved to accommodate to and incorporate aspects that radical historians and the Aboriginal struggle have shed light on, but in a pretty puerile and anodyne fashion. So, for instance, British invasion is now part of the Australian curriculum, as is features of the last 80 years of struggle for freedom by Indigenous people. Another obvious thing is that pretty much every government or official public function now starts with an acknowledgement to or a welcome to country. Even Australia Day usually features an Aboriginal speaker or makes some reference to Aboriginal people and the wounds of history. Aboriginal culture featured at the Sydney Olympics opening ceremony. It'll undoubtedly feature, you know, this Wednesday at the opening of the Commonwealth Games, and you can't imagine a Games without it now. There have also been key milestones in the process. Hawke's initial treaty proposal in 1988, the Mabo High Court decision, Keating's Redfern speech, Bringing Them Home report, Kevin Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generations, and more recently, the current push from politicians for constitutional recognition. Partly, this has allowed for some recognition of Aboriginal culture and to some degree of the evils of the past, but we certainly can't talk about the present, to be incorporated into the official Australian culture. However, it has to be said, many of these shifts have been really shallow, given that there was no compensation attached to Rudd's apology, and Turnbull flatly dismissed the Uluru statement that came out of his push to try to get support for constitutional recognition. Alongside that, there's also been a renewal in atrocities committed against Australia's Indigenous population. The Northern Territory intervention continues to destroy Aboriginal communities and steal children from families. We now have the horrific situation where more children are in state care than ever before under any generation of the stolen generations. The basics card has been rolled out to wider and wider areas of Australia. This year's Closing the Gap report showed the federal government continues to underfund critical health and education infrastructure in Indigenous communities. Indigenous incarceration and Aboriginal black deaths in custody continue at horrific rates, despite the Royal Commission taking place over 20 years ago. Dylan Voller has helped to remove the veil off the brutal youth justice regime. It was only 3 years ago that federal and Western Australian governments were attempting to forcibly remove or forcibly shut down remote Aboriginal communities. And just this year, the Sunrise program openly advocated for a new stolen generation. So because of these, and that despite their best efforts, the ruling class has not been able to completely write out Australia's genocidal past, a new front has opened up in the recent history wars, that of January 26th and Australia Day. So a bit of history about Australia Day. Now, it might seem that it's, you know, always been there, it's such an intrinsic part of Australia, but it's only been a national holiday on January 26th since 1994. So the Labor Party, first under Bob Hawke and later Paul Keating, were key to forging a new form of Australian nationalism. While they continued to deny reparations and to Indigenous people who'd suffered since colonisation, the new nationalism finally discarded the leftovers of British colonialism, was about presenting the economic benefits of multiculturalism and pluralism as Australian companies expanded into Asian markets and welcomed greater immigration. Australians ceased to be British subjects only in 1984, also when Australia's national anthem of God Save the Queen was replaced with Advance Australia Fair. The bicentenary of invasion was organised for January 26, 1988, with the motto of Living Together, yet it was met with the largest protest since the Vietnam War moratorium marches, with 40,000 protesting in the streets of Sydney. John Howard's administration, taking power in 1996, pushed January 26 celebrations into overdrive. And it was happened to be under his leadership that Triple J, a government-funded national radio show, put their Hottest 100 music countdown on January 26 from 1998 onwards, normalising for a whole new generation of young people that the day was one that should simply be about celebration, beers, barbecues and collective amnesia about Australia's brutal past. But alongside that, it has always been a day marked with protest, as governments of both stripes have continued to deny justice to Indigenous Australia. The first day of mourning took place in 1938, when the Australian government attempted to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Captain Phillip's landing in Sydney Cove. And if you'd like to hear more about that rally, I'm going to plug the William Ferguson session happening after this. This year's Invasion Day protest was some of the largest ever, with tens of thousands marching in Sydney and Melbourne and thousands in other cities, clearly outnumbering the official Australia Day celebrations. And there really is serious momentum behind changing the date, with three local councils refusing to have Australia Day celebrations on January 26 and Triple J shifting the date of their Hottest 100 this year. I'm not sure if it was national, but the Triple M radio show, maybe it wasn't, Triple M, when in response to Triple J, called their own Ozzest 100 to happen on January 26th, but even they felt pressure to run ads all throughout it, saying they supported changing the date. However, no other day would deliver any kind of justice for Indigenous people. Australia was founded on genocide and invasion, and so any other day would be just as neglectful of Australia's past. And while it may seem novel about a new day, it's not actually a new question to change the date. So back in 1888, nationalists were trying to argue that Australia Day should be December 3 to mark the Eureka Stockade, when, according to them, Australia set her teeth in the face of the British Lion. The first nationalist celebrations in schools weren't Australia Day, they were Empire Day and Wattle Day, held on different dates throughout the years. A different day will not change the reality that we still live in the same barbaric society of inequality and gruelling oppression. As Indigenous author Tony Burch articulated from the platform of Melbourne's Invasion Day rally this year, to those who are suggesting that we change the date, for those who are suggesting we hold this event on another date, this country does not deserve a national celebration in any capacity. And alongside the history of genocide, the whole January 26 is also about fostering nationalism. And so, as Tony Burch also wrote for The Guardian, a change to the date of an unreflected national pageant will do nothing to shake the collective psyche from a pathological need to wave a flag dominated by a symbol of imperialism and bloody conquest. So this nationalist flag waving is not meant to simply just cover over the crimes against Aboriginal people, but also attempts to bind us to a false sense of unity. Whether that's between, you know, the unemployed struggling by on scraps, or trade unionists denied the right to strike, or public housing tenants being thrown out of their homes as land is sold to developers, apparently all of us are meant to have something in common with the rich shits like Gina Rinehart and Malcolm Turnbull, who are responsible for why our lives are so difficult. So without the work of historians and authors like Manning Clark, Henry Reynolds, Lyndall Ryan, and so on, Australia's brutal past would be that much harder to uncover. But they were also a product of their times, as the radical movements of the 1960s challenged everything about their society. And just as it was then, the history wars today cannot be won only in the lamplight of academic halls or in the pages of newspapers, but will be won in the streets and in the workplaces. That's why it's been so refreshing this year to see the debates over January 26 haven't just been academic, but they've seen such huge increases in attendance to Invasion Day rallies all across the country. So through this, with masses of people engaging, with a clarity of ideas in the struggles against both Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten, and by building a movement of everyday people, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to fight against the system, we can truly win not only the history wars, but the class war for freedom and justice for all.